Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Person has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
oh! Big stop!
Oh!
Oh,
brother!
Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Hello and welcome back to the Over Back Classic NBA podcast at harborparoxysm.com. I am Jason Mann, and Rich can't be here today. He's got some he's got busy elsewhere, so we brought in a special guest to co-host for today. Welcome back to the show, Adam Cribbley. Adam, good to be with you.
Thanks for having me on.
No problem. And we are going to talk about an interesting topic, which we always talk about on the Over and Back podcast. We're going to talk about players who only appeared on an all-NBA or ABA first team and then never were selected all-league again. And I think this is interesting, just kind of the idea of that, okay, you are a top five player for one season and then, you know, never are again, or, you know, at least rated by the media of the time. And I just think it's sort of interesting because this is actually a fairly rare thing to happen. It's only happened 15 times in NBA ABA history, and eight of those times happened, you know, during the ABA year. So, you know, kind of a years in which the league, you know, was obviously a greater amount of parity and a greater amount of talent dilution because of expansion, because of all the ABA teams.
Well, I thought it was interesting that there's such a spread. So I kind of anticipated the ABA-NBA issue, but the fact that, you know, the earliest was in the 40s and the most recent, obviously, is Anthony Davis, as we'll talk about in a little bit, in 2015. But I was amazed that there was such a spread, that there was no really decade or era that wasn't represented. It was fairly consistent every couple of years that outside of that, you know, that high instance during the pre-merger years. But there's been pretty consistent every couple of years a player seems to make the list.
Yeah, I mean, in more recent years, yes, that's definitely true. I mean, it was a little bit harder to do before the third all-NBA team was added in 1989, I believe. Before then, there were just two all-NBA teams, and, you know, it's just – it's easier for a guy to be on a first team 1 year and then a third, you know, get a third team before he fades out or whatever. So it's a little bit, it's rarer in the earliest history of the league, but once we hit the late 60s and so, yeah, you're right. It is kind of a consistent every few years type thing. So I guess we will crack into it then.
Sounds good.
So we start in the BAA, one of the NBA's two predecessors merging with the NBL just a couple years later. The 1948 BAA, Howie Delmar, he was with the Philadelphia Warriors, only actually played three seasons. The previous year, the Warriors had won the finals in 48. When Delmar made the first team, they had lost in the finals. He was a guard, a point guard, was first in the league in assists, eighth in the league in win shares, first in defensive win shares, which is not necessarily the best metric ever, but we're kind of lacking stats for 1948. So that's the kind of the best we can give as far as why he may have made this first team. But pretty much, you know, team success, defense, and his passing, I think, would be primarily the reasons for him being on this list.
Yeah, it seems to be the only thing that really stands out outside of course, the idea that he had a strong team. And obviously, you know, Philadelphia, the Warriors were one of the stronger teams in the BAA. So I think he probably got some headlines for that. But outside of that, yeah, it's kind of hard to tell why he made the first team. And
his
was a new name.
Yes, not a whole lot written about him.
No.
But, his teammate Joel Folks was also on the first team. He's much more famous, one of the pioneers of the jump shot and one of the really one of the first great scorers in the NBA. The first player to reach 60 points, and then it took almost a decade for that to be reached again in the NBA before the craziness of the Wilt era. He only played three seasons, was 26 when he retired, went to coach the University of Pennsylvania, and then later made it to was a longtime Stanford coach, whom he led the NCAA title in 1942. So, not a whole lot more on Howie Delmore, unfortunately, but an interesting footnote in basketball history nonetheless.
Well, I mean, he was playing in an era, too, when there was better money in coaching than in playing. So, I mean, it was probably an economic decision in 48 that he decided, to hang up the sneakers to make a little more money coaching Penn.
Yeah, that's what I figured as well. So, I was wondering if there's a bank called Penn if you worked there as a teller. Anyway, bad jokes aside.
That was pretty bad.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So we might cut that out. You never know. Moving on to 1968 in the ABA, Charles Williams, who was nicknamed a Sweet Charlie. This was his first season of his sixth in his ABA career. He was a point guard and shooting guard. This season, he averaged seventh in the league with 20.8 points per game. And he was a teammate alongside with Connie Hawkins, who led the Pittsburgh Pipers to the ABA title. So what else is interesting about Sweet Charlie?
Well, Sweet Charlie is actually mentioned quite a bit in Terry Pluto's book, Loose Balls, that covers the history of the ABA. And in fact, he was one of the players interviewed for it. And so he has a lot of really interesting insights in it, mostly about other players that played in the league. But one thing I found really interesting was that he kind of had this chemistry with Connie Hawkins. And Hawkins was famous for having these giant hands that were just huge, enormous hands. And so Hawkins would get a rebound, and Williams would Sweet Charlie would go to kind of the 3-point line area for an outlet pass, and defenders were waiting on it, so they'd try to jump the pass, and Hawkins would kind of the only thing I can equate it to is kind of in football, like a hook and go. So Hawkins would fake a short pass, and as soon as he would fake the short pass, Sweet Charlie would go deep and catch the touchdown pass, the layup. And so he apparently did this all the time, and apparently teams didn't catch on, and there wasn't a lot of game film in the ABA, this combination of, Hawkins to Charlie Williams was apparently like a really tremendous tandem in the first year of the ABA when they won the title as the Pipers.
Yeah. It didn't go quite as well in 69. And then, Hawkins moved on to the NBA to play with the Suns. The Pipers kind of had a crazy history because they actually moved the next season to Minnesota, then they moved back to Pittsburgh, and then they changed their name from the Pipers to the Condors. Then he moved on to Memphis, who went from the Pros to the Tams. So he was like, every season he played, he seemed to either move cities or the team's name would change. So one of those only in the ABA crazy instability type stories.
Yeah, he only played for a couple different franchises, but he ended up playing, in five cities for six teams or whatever. It's definitely reminiscent of those, especially the early ABA days when teams were moving around a lot. And in Memphis, he actually played for Charles Finley, the Oakland A's owner.
Charles Finley, I believe.
Finley, sorry. Who famously is kind of the bad guy or almost the evil boss for the 1970s Oakland Athletics. And then he, owns a pro ABA team on the side. And Sweet Charlie got to play for Finley in the ABA for a couple of years.
Yeah. Another thing that Hawkins and Williams had in common is that they both had been blackballed from professional basketball because of a failure to report bribes. It lasted for a long time for Hawkins. For Williams, it only lasted a year or two before he, went to the ABA as well. The ABA didn't care so much about that, thankfully. And both, you know, there was the charges for that were thin, particularly for Hawkins. So, but it was one of those things where they were so paranoid about it that anybody who had any sort of even vague association with gambling was taken out. And looking kind of at advanced stats, probably he didn't necessarily have the best case for being on the All-NBA team, but of course they didn't really know that back then. But he was 49th in true shooting percentage, even though he was 7th in the league in scoring, and he was 52nd in win shares per 48. So not really necessarily where you would have the caliber of a All-NBA first team guy, and you know, relatively short career, but you know, managed to have one really memorable season.
I think part of that too is like with Howie Dalmar, when you're on a great team and you're one of the better several players in a relatively small league, you're going to be more likely to pick up that acclaim. And so, I mean, he was a top two or three player on the championship winning team. So I'm sure that went a long way too to help solidify the spot on the first team.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can totally understand the thinking behind it. And you know, nothing wrong with it. It's just, you know, if you looked a little bit deeper at, you know, kind of what we can, pull from it now, just based on that. Yeah, probably not, you know, the best choice for that, but hey, you know, we're not taking away from him. We would never
not Sweet Charlie. One interesting fact. So I love Basketball Reference, and I love diving in to just see the crazy stats you can find or whatever. And I found one for Charles Williams, or Charlie Williams. In 1970-71, he played in 88 games. He was traded that season in the middle of the year, and an imbalanced schedule meant that he played, you know, six extra games than everybody else. This is actually the second most of all time in ABA or NBA history, these 88 games. And first, of course, you know, as befitting the ABA, is as another Charles Williams, who went by Chuck Williams and played in the ABA. So this, you know, the imbalanced schedule, I think, played some tricks. But yeah, an 88 game season. So he didn't get first team that year, but he definitely earned his paychecks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Walt Bellamy, I think he's tied with as well. It was a little bit easier to do that in the ABA because the ABA had 84 games instead of 82. But
oh, that's right. That's right.
But yeah, it's still that's a lot of games. So. So I guess we'll move on to the next season, 1969 in the NBA, and two teammates actually accomplished this feat. Wes Unseld in his rookie season and Earl Monroe in his second season for the Baltimore Bullets. They improved quite a bit from 36 to 57 wins. They were the record was first in the NBA, but they were a little bit not quite as good in SRS. They were fourth in the league, still very near the top. And they ended up underwhelming a little bit in the playoffs, being swept in the first round by the Knicks. And Unseld, as a rookie, also won the MVP in a fairly overwhelming vote, which was done by the players. It's funny because he never actually finished in the top eight in voting in MVP. That season, he averaged 13.8 points per game, 18.2 rebounds per game, which was fifth in the league, and then ninth in win shares per 48. Meanwhile, Monroe, shooting guard, averaged 24.2 points per game, which was second in the league, 4.2 assists per game, and he was 20th in win shares per 48. So you know, both up there in that stat, you can definitely see you know, their case for that. I feel like Unseld is another, for at least the MVP itself, the production isn't necessarily, it makes that a little bit of an odd vote, but you know, you make a lot of points here, and we've made that before about how, you know, Unseld was definitely maybe a guy that production doesn't necessarily paint the best picture for him. There's more to his game than and that, and for a lot of guys, but I think Unseld in particular.
Well, you know, he's such an odd case when he wins the MVP, because he's, you know, he's not the best player in the league, not by a long shot. You know, by any, you know, he was well known for rebounding, and he was fifth in the league in rebounding, and you know, he's well known for all these things that are kind of intangible qualities. The, you know, long outlet passes and setting good screens and being a solid teammate. I mean, really, if you look to like a modern comparison, that's kind of like Joakim Noah 2 or 3 years ago winning the MVP. Like, you know, we'll talk about him in a little bit, but but it's just he's completely underwhelming in almost every way. So the first team, is a stretch. In 69, you still have Wilt Chamberlain, you still have Willis Reed, and for Unseld to make the first team, I think was kind of a stretch. And you see that obviously when he's not in the top eight in MVP voting again in his career. That unselfishness, people were kind of taken by the fact that they improved by 21 games and people loved how he played. But that really, he probably doesn't deserve that shot.
Yeah. But again, we're not taking away from him. So, sure. Yeah, I was thinking, Unseld, you could kind of compare to Nash's first MVP. I mean, there's a lot of that. They're obviously very different players, but there's a lot of that being really enjoyable to watch and turning around the franchise and doing things that led to them, being successful. Even though, again, Nash's productivity wasn't necessarily the best either, but, it was one of those things that, you kind of just had to see it. So, yeah.
Now, the Earl the Pearl really surprised me that this was his only first or second team selection. I knew he kind of plays second fiddle once he gets to New York after he's traded to the Knicks, alongside Walt Frazier. He's overshadowed by Frazier in New York. But really, I was surprised he hadn't earned one, in a season or two before in Baltimore because he was so outstanding and kind of flashy. And, you talked about Steve Nash gets an MVP award because it's fan friendly and exciting. And I mean, Earl the Pearl was all that, in the late 60s. So I was kind of surprised that this was, Monroe's only time on the first or second team.
Yeah. In Baltimore, they were, they made the 71 finals, but they were like a 42 win team so the regular season success wasn't exactly there. I mean, they were definitely overshadowed by the next year. And then the Bucks as well were kind of the up and coming team on the rise, so they didn't quite have that same hoopla around them, I guess. But yeah, I mean it's interesting that because both these guys are obviously like top 50, they're on the top 50 list of all time. Unseld was a 5-time All-Star. Monroe was a 4-time All-Star. They had a lot of success and they had celebrated careers. It is really interesting that these are. Just so two such accomplished players, and yet, yeah, only the one time on the All NBA first team. So for each, so that's that is an odd thing. It's kind of a little bit hard to explain. In a league where when they played, where the talent was spread out more, so you think that in a thinner league they would have had a better opportunity to make that. And there's still plenty of talent in the NBA when they're playing. I mean, I'm not trying to say there isn't a lot still, but it's definitely a different environment than it would have been earlier in the 60s or in different times in the NBA.
Sure. And I think that, you brought up a point earlier is that there's no third team all league. So I really enjoy one of the things Curtis Harris did, I think a year ago now or 2 years ago, where he did the Lost All NBA third teams, where he went through and, he kind of panpicked the players he thought earned third team nods through the mid late 60s, to I think the mid 70s. And he thought Monroe was worthy of a third team. 3 times and Unseld at least one other time. So, I mean, with a third team, they probably don't make this list. At least Monroe probably gets at least one third team nod. But really, I think they're also struggling with the era in which they played. So Unseld, like I said, is behind, Willis Reed, Wilt Chamberlain, Bill Russell early in his career, and then, Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar later. So, I mean, the center position was stacked in the late 60s and through the mid 70s. And then Earl the Pearl is behind, Walt Frazier and Jerry West and Oscar Robertson. I mean, really, there was a lot of competition, especially at those spots. So I think, at guard and center, trying to get on the first or second team in the late 60s and early 70s was probably, I mean, it was a crowded field. So, it's understandable in some ways why they each only made one first team.
Yeah, definitely. It is understandable, but it's surprising still.
Sure.
When you think about it, when you make the case, absolutely makes sense. But it's still off the top of here, it's like, oh wow, two of the top 50 players of all time only had that level of accomplishment. Of course, Monroe didn't end up making the over and back top 50, but Unseld did. So. So next we go to the very next season, 1970. So three seasons in a row of this. Now back to the ABA, and Bob Verga, who he was in his third season. He played six in all, playing for the Carolina Cougars. He averaged 27.5 points per game, was second in the league in that, was 27th in the league in win shares per 48. So, a probably not first team all ABA level in that metric, but, but again, the scoring and the Carolina Cougars had just moved the Houston franchise, I believe, from before. And they were kind of a strong, they had played pretty well that season. So, obviously, again, another thing with the kind of the surprising team success and the actually they're only 42-42, so they didn't have necessarily super team success, but the scoring and everything makes that pretty understandable. He was only a one-time All-Star in the same season, only played six seasons, so he wasn't really like a necessarily. This is definitely kind of a, 1 year blip for him, kind of like it is for Charlie Williams, as opposed to the Unseld Monroe of having great careers, but only happening to reach that plateau, one time.
Yeah, he was definitely a brief flame. He lasted really one season as a star. And I mean, you kind of see this, I guess. I equate this more to baseball. So I equate this as, the player who averages 13 home runs a year and then busts out with 50 and then back to 13. He's a journeyman. He's a role player.
He's the Brady Anderson of the
exactly. Yeah. Yep. And of course that's the name that popped into my head too. So, he's Bob Berger is the Brady Anderson of the ABA.
There you go. He had another guy well-traveled. He had played already, Dallas, Denver, New York and Houston. And then of course Houston had moved to Carolina and they signed a bunch of players who played college in that era. Bob Verga played at Duke and he has the Duke record for most points per game in a season. And they even signed a local coach, Bones McKinney, who had led Wake Forest to Final Four in 62. And like I said, he became a role player afterward and retired after the 74 season.
Yep.
And next, we stay in the ABA. 1972, it is Bill Melchione. I don't know exactly how to pronounce that, but do you know how to pronounce
it? Got it.
Oh, there you go. Yep. Nice. Got it. I meant to check that before we did the show, and I forgot. So glad I had a nice guess. He is and he's not someone I really had heard of, honestly, before I did research for this, but he was point guard for the Nets in his fifth season, played nine in his career. He began his career as a reserve on the 1967 Sixers, one of the greatest teams of all time, single-season teams of all time, along with Wilt and company. Then later was cut from that team and made his way to the ABA as a free agent in 1970, and then ended up being a really good player for the Nets in the 70s. And his number, in fact, number 25, is retired by the Nets. So was a three-time All-Star as well. So quite a good player.
I hadn't heard of him before I read Dr. J released an autobiography, I think it was in 2015.
Or it might have been late 2014, but it is recent. Yeah, I haven't read it yet, but it's on my list.
That's the only way I knew him, because he mentions Melchione and the fact that, Melchione was one of those players that was a really good player on mediocre, mediocre average teams. And then when Irving came in, the Nets kind of turned over their roster a little bit, and he went from starting and on the all-star all-star player to kind of a role player coming off the bench, providing some of that hustle and grit and toughness, and step back from the 20 point per game scorer into a role on a championship team. So I mean, it's kind of that story of great player, great player on a mediocre team and a mediocre player on a great team.
Right. Yeah, and he kind of bridged the Rick Barry into Julius Erving-led teams. the highlight for Barry was that year in 72, they were a 44 win team, but then they upset the 68 win Kentucky Colonels in the postseason, made the finals, ended up losing there. And then in 74 and 76, once Julius Erving came along, they won the ABA title both years. So, we're quite a fantastic team. In 72, he averaged 21 points per game, which was 12th in the league, 8.4 assists per game, first in the league. He also led the league in assists in 71. And in 72, he was 17th in win shares per 48. So, even though he, like I said, not a megastar or anything, but I think a big enough of a star and accomplished enough of a guy where it's a little bit more than just, oh, he happened to be really great this one season. I mean, he was a very steady and good contributor to some very good teams for quite a while. So,
I think part of that too is that he didn't play in the NBA. He retired before the merger, right before the merger. And so he doesn't have that kind of carryover where he might have, I don't know that he would have made any NBA team, any all-star teams or anything later, but he might have had a little bit of a run in the NBA, especially after the Nets traded Irving and there was no one left in New York or New Jersey. So yeah, he kind of gets overshadowed by Rick Barry and then Julius Erving, and then he leaves before the merger. So, I mean, he flies under the radar, but he was definitely more than just a one hit wonder or one season wonder.
Yes, absolutely. So, so next is the next season, 1973, again in the ABA. Warren Jabali. This was his fifth season of seven in the league. He was played point guard and shooting guard for the Denver Rockets, who were close to changing their name to the Nuggets. They would do so in 1975. He was originally Warren Armstrong, but he changed it to Jabali, which means rock in Swahili. He was well known for his, for a lot of things. He was known for his social activism. He was known for, being an incredibly tough player. He had a reputation as one of the most feared defenders in all of basketball. And he also was nicknamed Batman because he could fly through the air. So, and he was kind of also the guy who, sort of butted heads a little bit, the racial climate of the 60s and 70s made it hard for African Americans who were strong proponents of equal rights, and he wrote quite eloquently about the situation that he dealt with during his career and sort of his feelings on having not lived around white people for most of his life and then going into basketball and then how to deal with that. So it's really interesting thoughts on that. Really, he's since passed away, but seems like a really complicated, interesting guy, and was also a very good player.
He was. No, and he I mentioned Terry Pluto's book Loose Balls earlier, and Jabali is dealt with quite a bit in there because he kind of typifies the one aspect of the ABA, the notion that the ABA is much more of a street game, a playground game, a free-flowing game, and is honestly in the mid-70s kind of more African American friendly than was the NBA. And he comes in and he's almost like a Ron Artest light, a shorter Ron Artest, where he comes in and he's a tough defender. People know not to screw with him because he's kind of vicious. He stomped on the head of an opposing player during one fight. No one wanted to mess with him after that. So, yeah. He kind of comes and he bounces around the league quite a bit. He plays for, I think, six different teams, and that's kind of becomes his MO. So he comes in, he wears out his welcome through his social activism, and he's outspoken, and he's kind of hard nosed, and he's a tough guy, and then he moves on. But he's undoubtedly a great basketball player. He could score, he can rebound, he can pass. He's an amazing defender. So I mean, I think he's kind of underrated. If you look back at his career, it was short. It was in the ABA, but he was really he could do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, and he suffered a pretty bad knee injury. I think around seven or. Yeah, I think it was before this, but the effects of that didn't, took hold, as he got older. But during this season, the 73 season, he was fourth in win shares per 48, 17 points per game, 6.6 assists per game, 5.2 rebounds, and a .561 true shooting percentage. He is only one of 18 players in NBA AB history to reach those milestones. So pretty good season. He had led the Oakland Hawks to the ABA title as a rookie in 1969. Then he had bounced around the league. He was also a teammate of Rick Barry as well, though Barry was injured during that season, during most of the season, so didn't actually play in the finals to win that championship. And he was also the MVP of the 73 All-Star game as well. So, despite, like I said, despite having bouncing around and having some issues, he still, having those injuries, he still, had incredible talent and managed to make a mark in a relatively short career.
Sure.
So next we have Gail Goodrich, who was 1974 in the NBA. This is his ninth season out of 14. He was on the Lakers at the time. He had started with the Lakers, then went to the Suns, then went back to the Lakers. He'd also been a big UCLA star. He'd led that team to the first two titles under John Wooden. They would win eight in a row, I believe. He was a he was a really good companion to Jerry West, a very good shooting guard, and for this season he averaged I forgot to mark it down here. hold on a second. For this season, he averaged 25.3 points per game and 5.2 assists per game, and honestly doesn't really stand out as like being a significantly better season than any of his other really good years. In fact, the 72 season probably is his best statistical season. It was still a very good season, but it was definitely not like this is sort of an odd choice to pick for being his best season. Go ahead.
No, you're right. I mean, he's definitely overshadowed on the 72 championship team though by Wilt and Jerry West. And in 74, right. Wilt's gone.
West hurt in 74?
West, I'm not sure. He didn't play a lot in 74. I don't think. I think
he was hurt that year. So yeah, I don't think he played that much. So that they were. They were 47 and 35 that year, and West only played 31 games. Yep. Yeah, so that's probably a good reason why they they had Connie Hawkins as well toward the end of his career, but they didn't really have many of the productive players. So,
and it was the Lakers, and they were two seasons removed from an all time great season, and now Goodrich is still putting up 25 points and not playing any defense at all, and. I love some of the comments. I was going through some old Basketball Digest old art magazine articles and stuff. And journalist said that Goodrich was a great fast break shooter that has managed to last 14 years without playing at the other end of the floor. Maybe that's his secret. So he's attributing his longevity to the fact he doesn't play any defense.
Yes.
He's left-handed. He's got the nickname Stumpy because he's kind of short and has short legs, but he scores 25 a game. So, I mean, to me, I see kind of, Gail Goodrich as that guy at the guy that shows up at the YMCA and you don't really think he's that good. And then, he doesn't look the part, and then he comes out and he scores all the points and doesn't play any defense. So I think he's on the YMCA All-Star team.
Yes, absolutely. He had led the 72 Lakers in scoring as well. The 33 straight win team. I don't know if there's like a really necessarily a standout case in terms of whether there's another, all NBA team that he could have made, but, he was a 5-time All-Star. He was definitely, an accomplished player and, considered a, I guess more of like a mid-level star of his day. He was sort of the equivalent, I guess, of like the James Worthy to Magic Johnson type level,
That's a good comparison.
Yeah. So.
And when if you look at the times that he didn't make, when he had similar seasons and didn't make the first team, he kind of like Earl Monroe is stuck behind Jerry West and Walt Frazier, and he has Oscar Robertson in front of him. And so really with those three, you could pencil into the first and second team for, you know, 5 or 6 seasons. And so really you had Gale Goodrich and Earl Monroe and guys like Lou Hudson for the Hawks and Archie Clark, who was, I think, with Baltimore by then. You know, they're kind of vying for that last spot. And so to make the first or second team was, you know, really down to one spot that you have a kind of a handful of guys fighting for. And it just so happened, I guess, in 74 that the Gale Goodrich had his name called and it was his turn.
Yeah. Well, you know, good for him. We're definitely not going to take away from him, as we keep saying. So as
that's
I,
right.
I guess I keep saying it. But
especially a man named Stumpy.
Yes. No, we would never do that with Stumpy. Yeah. I mean, he had to live with that for his for his life. So let him keep his All-Star or his All-NBA. So next we have Billy Knight of 1976 in the ABA, the small forward for the Indiana Pacers. This is his second season of 11 in both leagues. This is the final season for the ABA. He's also the future general manager of my Atlanta Hawks, put together the 2004-2005 Atlanta Hawks team that I like to reference, and also famously drafted Marvin Williams ahead of Chris Paul. So we don't care much for Billy Knight in Atlanta Hawks fan circles. He also gets confused with Billy King a lot, including on Billy Knight's Wikipedia page. So at least last time I checked, he was confused there. So that's always fun. He was a 2-time All-Star. He had another strong season in 77 before, you know, kind of moving to the NBA, and then sort of fell off a bit, sort of bounced around a bit, and then sort of had a second run with Indiana where he kind of settled into a mid-level player in the early 80s. But he was, he actually is on quite a few of the leaderboards in ABA history, or excuse me, not in ABA history, but in Indiana Pacers history, relatively like top 5 in points and, you know, a few of the other things, which is kind of interesting. But in 76, he averaged 28.1 points per game, 10.1 rebounds, 3.7 assists. So, a pretty well-rounded player. Had another strong season, like I said, in 77, making the All-Star team, and that was, you know, that was about it. But, you know, that was a pretty good run.
Well, I mean, if you look at when he broke into the league, he also suffered from some really bad timing. So he comes into the ABA and he plays second fiddle to Julius Erving, obviously, in the ABA. And then he moves to the NBA. And if you look at he had really one exceptional season in the NBA in 1977, like you said, when he made the All-Star team. But if you look at the first team, all NBA forwards in 77 were Elvin Hayes and David Thompson. And the second team then were George McGinnis and Julius Erving.
Yeah.
So I mean, really breaking into that foursome, that's tough.
Yeah.
And he definitely would have been a third teamer if it had existed. But one thing I love about Billy Knight, so I'm a Pacers fan, and this, although I wasn't yet born, was really a dark time in Pacers history. So before they had all these costs associated with the merger and had to pay them, and they were, you know, front office staff's check were bouncing, and so they actually held a telethon to try to raise some money. And one of the cost cutting measures that they came up with was to, you know, sell some of their best players. So they traded Billy Knight to Buffalo, and then in return they got Adrian Dantley, who lasted, you know, a third of a season or half a season, and they traded him to the Lakers for James Edwards. So they start with an all ABA team, Billy Knight, and two trades later end up with James Edwards. So it was a less than stellar time in Pacers history.
Yes, yeah, they really were. I mean, those 80s years were pretty lean up until they got Reggie Miller.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, it's funny because of course the Pacers are maybe the best team of the 70s. If you look at, they won it with 3 championships, I believe, and you just had these great players. I mean, you know, you could match them up with any of the NBA great teams of that era, and they were right there. So, but yeah, that history, I guess, is separated by a lack of anything in the NBA up until Reggie Miller, that there's not much memory of, you know, there's nothing linking those ABA teams to the NBA teams. So I feel like that's kind of forgotten a little bit more than it would be otherwise. But yeah,
I think Pacers fans want to forget the 80s. So it was, yeah. It was a dark time. You know, high draft picks that didn't pan out, and
yeah.
Trading away some,
Clark Kelly gets hurt, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it was a forgettable time, you know, when they traded the pick that would become Sam Bowie. So, you know, they could have sat there and got Michael Jordan, but you know,
that's right. Yeah.
Bygones and all that.
That was, I read something recently on James Edwards on the Pacers, and I feel like he's related somehow to that. Like, I feel like, I feel like the GM for the Pacers made some sort of trade related to James Edwards. Like they hadn't made, or if James Edwards, I forget the particular circumstances of it now, but somehow James Edwards is involved in the because they traded for Tom Owens, I believe, to the Blazers. So I forget the connection now, but anyway, you'll just have to take my word for it.
I was gonna say part of it is that. He signed away as a free agent, so all of a sudden the Pacers were struggling for a center, and Tom Owens for the Blazers
That's
seemed like
was.
A great choice.
Okay, yes.
So yeah, no, we'll blame James Edwards. So we can blame Billy Knight via Adrian Dantley via James Edwards for the fact that the Pacers didn't get Michael Jordan.
Yeah, well, that's a shame. Anything else interesting about Billy Knight before we move on to our next contestant?
Not really. I mean, the only other thing about Billy Knight that I thought was interesting is that, like a lot of these players, it's, you know, he's an exceptional scorer. He puts up such great scoring numbers, and people just destroy him for his defense. So they one comparison that was made at the time was that he was kind of like Cassie Russell, who was his name was kind of like, if you mention today James Harden in defense, people are like, oh, James Harden doesn't play defense. Well, that was Cassie Russell in the 70s. So compared to Cassie Russell was kind of a wink and a nod that, yeah, he can score, but you know, you might as well just play 4-on-5 at the other end. So yeah, Billy Knight kind of fit into that category as a, you know, score first, score second, score third kind of player on some pretty, like I said, some pretty poor Pacer teams.
Yeah, the thing about Billy Knight as a GM is that he kept – there was the thing where for a while the Hawks, like, they just wanted to be all small forwards. I mean, they had Josh Smith, sure. They had Josh Childress, they had Marvin Williams, and they had Joe Johnson. They would play them all together, and it was pointed out that all of those guys were basically the same height as Billy Knight. You know, Billy Knight kept running draft players who reminded him of himself. So I don't know if that's
makes sense.
Literally true, but that's, you know, that obviously would sort of what it seemed like. So
and they wouldn't have come together on your Hawks team without that. So
no, they would not. So so next is 1978, and we're back into the NBA. The mergers happened. Truck Robinson, it was his fourth season of 11 in the league. He was playing power forward for the New Orleans Jazz. He led the league in minutes played 3,638. That is the 18th most minutes in a season in NBA ABA history. Eight of those are from Wilt Chamberlain, two were from John Havlicek, two were from Elvin Hayes, one was Tiny Archibald, one was Spencer Haywood, one was Artis Gilmore, and two of them were Gerald Govan of the ABA, who I'm honestly not familiar with other than I'm having this incredible mark. So,
yeah, that's a new one to me.
But anyway, so, yeah, I mean, this is seems like it's a – I mean, he led the league in rebounds per game. 15.7, one of the first non-centers to ever lead the league in rebounding. He was first in defensive win shares, but not in the top 20 in any of the major advanced metrics. So this is, I think, you know, more along the lines of just playing a lot of minutes and getting a lot of counting stats. And, you know, not being a bad player, but probably not really, you know, this is definitely sort of a, you know, one hit wonder kind of thing, even though he hit a long career, but for the most part was a, you know, pretty solid, you know, goodish player, but not, you know, anywhere near this level.
No, he was pretty high profile at the time because he was part of the first crop of free agents. So in the summer of 77, we had the first time NBA players can switch teams as free agents. And so he signed with New Orleans, and it was actually one of the three or four biggest signings of the offseason. And so he was getting a lot of publicity, and he was teaming with Pete Maravich. And so Maravich was playing guard and Robinson was playing inside. And there was actually a lot of intrigue about that, whether they could play together, how they would play. Maravich kind of being Mr. Outside and Robinson kind of being Mr. Inside. And so there was a lot of publicity, and I think that's part of it too, is that all the eyes were on him, and he comes out and he pulls down 15.7 rebounds per game, and New Orleans was a hot and popular team at the time, so I'm sure that had something to do with it also.
Yeah, and they weren't good, but they were much better than they had been. They were 39-43. That was kind of a weird year because that was a season in which there were almost no like really good or really bad teams. Like everyone was kind of like stuck in the middle. So they actually they weren't necessarily that high in the standings, but that was a stronger year for them than they had been having. Actually, yeah, I guess their record in the from 76-78 actually wasn't. I always thought it was worse than it was, but they won 38, 35, and 39 wins. So it's not like they were quite the disaster that I was thinking that they were. But either way, it wasn't a massive success, but they did well enough. Yeah, I mean, he'd been stuck behind. He started in Washington. He'd been stuck behind Wes Unseld and Elvin Hayes. So this was kind of like he played briefly in Atlanta, but this was kind of his first opportunity to really shine as well after Atlanta, where he played half a season and did pretty well. And then went to Phoenix and played pretty well there, and then aged and had a few years in 3 years in New York, but by then he was older and not real productive. So, you had an interesting note about that free agency in 77 about almost a big three there in New Orleans.
Yeah. So when researching basketball, it's always fun. We talk about the big three of LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, as if they were the first to come up with that idea. And so they clearly weren't. We talked about Gail Goodrich along with, Jerry West and Wilt Chamberlain earlier. But in the summer of 77, there was actually talks that so Pete Maravich was already in Atlanta and Truck Robinson signed with Atlanta. And then Detroit center Bob Lanier almost joined him. And, his quote at the time was that they would have created three crucial spokes in the wheel. So he, kind of alludes to a big three, even without saying it specifically, right. the combination of Lanier and Robinson and Maravich would have hopefully elevated New Orleans. But instead, Lanier ends up, signing and staying with Detroit and Robinson and Maravich kind of, achieve middling success in New Orleans.
Right, right. Yeah. And they would, Maravich and Robinson would both be gone after the next season, and of course the Jazz would end up moving to Utah. So that was not destined to last very long. So
didn't work out.
Yeah. Speaking of a great big three, our next choice, we move forward 9 years in time. So after all these cluster of players in the 70s, we move on a little bit to 1987 in the NBA. One of the big three in Boston, Kevin McHale. This was his seventh season of 13. He was playing power forward for the Celtics, of course. Obviously, one of the greats of all time and one of the most memorable teams ever. So it's kind of surprising that he never made another All-NBA team, even like a second team. In early his career, he was coming off the bench. And, of course, there's part of the thing with, being part of a big three is you're sharing the credit. I mean, Larry Bird is the star, but you're sharing a lot of credit with Robert Parrish. So, determining who is getting kind of the credit for, as being the second spoke in that wheel, plus you have Dennis Johnson. Early on, you have, Tiny Archibald, other, good role players who were once stars or, still kind of stars in there. So it's, as part of being a great team, you have a lot of great players, and distributing credit for that can be difficult.
Sure. And I mean, he played the first nine seasons of his career without a third team All-NBA being there. So, yes. it's possible he earns one earlier in his career. But like you said, I think more importantly, he's coming off the bench. He's playing a role. And really until Larry Bird starts to tail off in the late 80s, it's definitely Larry Bird's team and McHale's second fiddle. And then, McHale has some foot injuries, some leg injuries, and ultimately kind of falls off not too long after Bird does. So, I think, if he had played a few more seasons, he might have, would have, could have, should have made another team or two.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was 35 at the end, but you're right. I mean, in 87, that means he sustains a major foot injury, and he's still very good, but never quite, he doesn't quite reach that same level again, and probably is less effective than he would have been his last couple years of his career, had he not had that injury.
Right.
But yeah, in 87, he had 26.1 points per game, 9.9 rebounds, 2.6 assists. He leads the league in field goal percentage at a .604. And the Celtics make the finals but lose to the Lakers. They're riddled with injuries that year and can't quite keep the magic from the previous year. That year, he was the first player in NBA history to shoot 60% or better from the field and 80% better from the free throw line in the same season. He was fourth in MVP voting that year behind Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, Larry Bird. Was fourth in the league in win shares per 48. Was one of five times in which he was top seven in win shares per 48. So definitely was, a guy where, based on production, you would think that he would have definitely had another All-NBA team. But yeah, as we talked about, there are reasons why it didn't quite happen.
Right.
The injury that he had, he famously played through a broken navicular bone in his right foot, ignored doctor's advice and played through the injury. And, unfortunately he limps when he walks today. And so, suffering the, effects of doing that and trying to do best for his team. But unfortunately for him, not being able to quite go as far as he wanted to.
Was that in the 87 playoffs that he broke his bone?
No, it was during the season.
Okay. And he tried to come back.
He played through it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't remember exactly when it occurred. My memory says that it happened late in the season, but I could be I can't exactly remember.
Yeah, I was gonna say I looked it up, and he only missed five games that season. So yeah, he didn't miss much time considering he had a broken navicular bone.
Yes. So next we move forward a little bit in time again, 7 years to 1994, and Latrell Sprewell. It was his second year in the league of 13 seasons. Chris Webber was his teammate's rookie season. That did not go quite swimmingly. He was played shooting guard, playing for the Golden State Warriors. He didn't have a very good season, and it was kind of a weird year because Michael Jordan just retired, so it definitely put a there was a hole in the shooting guard position. Obviously, the other thing that had happened was Reggie Lewis had passed away. Who had been an All-Star, was not an all, had not been an All-NBA player, but was definitely a candidate to be that as well. So I guess there were, there were reasons why there were fewer competition for shooting guards that year, even though, there were still quite a few, there were a lot of great point guards and also some very good shooting guards during that time.
Yeah, no, he definitely was worthy of making the list. Like you said, though, I think he's really aided by the fact that that Jordan's not there and there's some other injuries. So yeah, his 94 season was good. Looking through his stats, though, he was actually better a few years later. In 96-97, he finished with a PER of 19.7, .115 win shares per 48. But if you look at the guards who made it above Sprewell, there were six guards, so first, second, and third team in the 96-97 season. And so Tim Hardaway and Michael Jordan were the first team. Gary Payton and Mitch Richmond were the second team, and Penny Hardaway and John Stockton made the third team. But looking a little deeper, Penny Hardaway making the team over Sprewell is kind of questionable. Penny's a superstar, obviously, at that point. Shaquille O'Neal had left, there was Lil Penny. But he only played, so Hardaway only played in 59 games. And so, Sprewell averaged more points, assists, rebounds, and steals than did Penny Hardaway although advanced stats like win shares per 48, like Penny over Sprewell, you know, he probably should have made that team that year. But you know, more importantly to me, and I was like 14 or 15 during this season, was that this is also the year that NBA Jam Tournament Edition came out. And so like that was my game in, you know, 1994. And I loved, one of my favorite teams was the Warriors, because they had Latrell Sprewell. And so if you played through the game all the way, you could unlock a few extra players. Like I think the unlockables on that team were Tim Hardaway and Chris Mullin. But his originally they team up in 1994. They team up Latrell Sprewell with Ronnie Cicely and Tom Gugliotta. So his teammates left a little to be desired, but Sprewell is awesome in that game. So that's my, you know, 15-year-old memory of Latrell Sprewell, is being able to kick people's butt with the Warriors. So that to me was the most important thing about Sprewell.
And that seems like a valid thing to be the most important thing. Absolutely. Yeah, so in 94, 21 points per game, 4.7 assists, 4.9 rebounds, 2.2 assists, and he led the league in minutes played. Also was a second-team all-defensive player, although, as you pointed out, the Warriors were 23rd in points allowed that season, so not the best defense. But, you know, yeah, I mean, he was his reputation is a little bit weird because he was very good, but, you know, he wasn't after the joking incident in 1998 with Peter Carlesimo, his coach. You know, he wasn't going to be making any all NBA teams anymore. Though he was an all-star with the Knicks in 2001. So, you know, it's he was sort of like a guy who was more of, I mean, at his peak he was really good, but he didn't quite last it like that. Because I think he was more of like a borderline all-star player for most of his career rather than like a definite all-NBA selection. Although your case for him in 97, I do think is pretty strong.
Yeah, you know, he definitely fits on that edge of fringe all-star, good player on a good team. You know, he, like we've talked about a couple other players on poor teams, he could light it up and really put up a bunch of stats. But on a great team, he wasn't going to be a top one or two, or probably even third player. He was good but not great. And in 94, he had a great season, but also kind of everything fell into place.
Yeah. Now he did. Yeah, I mean, he did have some good years later with the Knicks and with the Timberwolves. He's led them to some pretty good. Led them to some pretty good years, and you know, a finals appearance for the Knicks, conference finals appearance for the Timberwolves. So you know, he was part of some winning teams later, but yeah, the stats were the production was not quite as strong there, understandably. Even though, you know, probably when you consider everything, the veteran savvy and all that, he probably was a better player by then.
Sure.
So the we'll kind of group the last three together since they're very recent. 2011, Derrick Rose, also his MVP season. He is selected to All-NBA first team. 2014, Joakim Noah it makes that selection. And then 2015, Anthony Davis. So I think we can say that for Anthony Davis, he is very likely to get another All-NBA selection. In this year's third season, he had 24.4 points per game, 10.2 rebounds per game, 1.5 steals, 2.9 blocks per game at age 21. He was first in PER in the league. It's the 11th best PER season ever. Second in the league in win shares per 48, 6th in box score plus minus. He's having this year in 2016 is not quite as good, although he's production-wise is rather close. His team is not performing very well, but I think there's, if not this year, he's very, very soon going to have another, at least second or third team All-NBA. It's almost impossible for me to believe that won't happen. Probably will happen this year. But for Rose and Noah, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I think either would have you'd have a hard time convincing me that either is going to make another first, second, or third team, or probably even an All-Star game. appearance again in their careers. Noah, I can't believe the cliff he seemed to have dropped off of. So, like, kind of, you know, again, I mentioned earlier that his game reminded me a little of Wes Unseld. Not a lot of scoring, a lot of rebounding, good passing, kind of a smart, crafty center, and maybe it's appropriate then that he only makes one first team, just like Wes.
There you go. Yeah. He's a two-time All-Star. That season, his seventh was 12.6 points per game, 11.3 rebounds, 5.4 assists per game, which is actually the seventh most assists per game for a center ever, which surprised me a little bit. He was fourth in MVP voting that year. Basically, what happened was the Bulls had traded Luol Deng after Derrick Rose was lost for the season. And so no one thought the Bulls were going to be any good. Then they ended up making a good run and even upset the Nets in the playoffs that year. He was also the defensive player of the year. And he was definitely the heart and soul of that team. They ran the offense through him. He played very hard. I think the falling off the cliff, he played through a lot of injuries and played a lot of minutes. And, he's around 30 now. So just sort of an age where, where players start to decline. Unfortunately, he's declined further than, more than most. I think the lack of shooting hurts him more than it even did, 3 or 4 years ago. And so it's kind of been unfortunate as well. And obviously for Derrick Rose, it's really just, he suffered a ACL tear the season after this during the playoffs and has been unable to return to form. Despite, like you said, he was awesome that year, 25 points per game, 7.7 assists per game. Even though the choice was to make him MVP was derided a little bit. I mean, he was fourth in win shares for the season and fourth in block score plus minus. I mean, he was definitely in that club when you look at the total case, the team success, everything. And I think he's probably going to become the first MVP. Rich has written about this, probably going to become the first MVP not to make the Hall of Fame, which is, kind of crazy to think about.
No, it makes sense. And I mean, you can hindsight 2020, go back and make him not MVP in 2011, but his case was solid. And there was a little apathy over voting for LeBron again, but that season stands up fine. And I think that, that unfortunately, as with Noah, injuries and a lot of playing time, thanks to Coach Thibodeau, is ultimately going to hamper him going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's it. So Adam, you want to let everyone know, where they can follow you on Twitter, anything else you want to let people know?
You can follow me on Twitter at Adam Cribble, AdamCribblez.
Cool. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Over and Back NBA. We're also on Facebook at the same name. You can find our podcast at hardwoodparoxysm.com. And check us out on iTunes if you want to leave us a rating and review. We are part of the HP Podcast Network. You can find either all the shows on the network at the HP Network feed, or you can just find us at our own feed, Over and Back NBA. So rating and review would be greatly appreciated. That's about it. Until next time, thanks for listening. Thanks again, Adam, for being on the show. And we'll be back again soon.